everyone. This is Dwayne Neustadter with Tony Tressault, and welcoming you to another episode of Tree Actions, the Human Forestry Podcast. And joining us today from lovely New Hampshire is none other than Mark Pachark. Ah, man, I thought I had it, but I don't. So, getting ready for the show, we learned that there's multiple ways of going about pronouncing Mark's last name, and he leaves it up to each individual to make their own determination on that. But welcome to the show, Mark. How are you doing today?
Hey, thanks, Dwayne. My last name is like interpretive dance. Everybody does it their own way, so I try not to judge people, and they can call me Mark. The splice guy, Mark the tree guy, Mark the whatever it is I do for them, they call me that. So, but thank you.
You're welcome. Well, we start our podcast off pretty much in the same way. We don't delve into a lot of introductions and so on. When we make our introduction, really having our guests describe or recall their first memory of where they felt a connection to trees.
Yeah. I've listened to a couple of the podcasts that you guys sent me, and it's a really intriguing question. It's funny because my customers all tell me their stories every time I go do a quote. So right. I was thinking about mine, and when I was looking over the podcast, and you were talking about the human forest. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I associate with the human forest is vulnerability. Because trees, if you damage a tree, the tree holds that wound, compartmentalizes it, but it reacts to that wound for the rest of the time that it's alive. And so a tree is actually vulnerable to all the things that happen around it and to it, and it can't like run away. And so for me, my earliest memories of trees is in my vulnerability. I had a rough childhood, and I would run into the forest and spend hours and hours of just being having solitude in the trees. I would climb to the top of a tree and sit and just cry out my frustrations. And so no one would know where I was. No one could hear me because I was up high enough out of earshot. And it was a safe place for me. So I spent a lot of time running into the forest to find my safety. And as I got older and I was still frustrated, I did what I recognize now as tree pruning. I used to find a good stout stick and I would break the lower limbs off the pine trees to make it easier to run through the forest, you know, just six yeah. feet up. And I'd break all the dead limbs off. And now that I'm actually doing tree work, there's so many days I realize I've come full circle from looking to the forest for safety to get out my frustration so I could survive another day. And now I'm in the forest making my living. I'm making money that lubricates my ability to teach people about trees and to be vulnerable. And the whole thing is one great big circle for me.
Very interesting. You know, when you're talking about running through the forest, breaking off lower branches to clear a path, it's interesting because where you go to, if you, where animals create their trails, especially the male species with the horns, you'll see at the height of the horns, all the branches have been somewhat cleared. And sometimes you got to elevate yourself. Like, you wonder how it is that moose can run through the forest so quietly, but if you get up to 7-8 foot level, to their eye level and above, you see where their horns have actually cleared little tunnels.
Yeah. And I grew up in Vermont on the banks of a river where it was farmland, and then the pine trees grew up in. So there were all sorts of lower limbs yeah. on the pine trees that had all died off after the rest of the forest caught up with it. Yeah. And so I was the first generation to run through those forests with the dead limbs. And those trees gave me a chance to get out all my frustration and my anger and my, like, all the questions I had of why life was difficult and all that. And I was knocking all those limbs off, and I was making a space. I was basically making a nest for me to live and grow up in. And after leaving the trees for a long time, going into the high-tech world, 24 years ago, I came back to trees, and now I feel more at home than I've ever felt in my whole life.
Wow. What an interesting and positive way to deal with life's frustrations and challenges, like things that are out of our control. I wish I'd thought of healthier ways of doing it like that myself.
Well, there was some times where it wasn't so healthy. I used to climb the small pine saplings with my friends that were near each other, and we would sway in the tops of the pine trees and try to have like a jousting match or whatever. And one time, my tree, when I swung back, the top of the tree broke out, and I landed on my back in the pine duff. And I remember my vision just getting smaller and smaller and smaller
Wow.
till it went black, and then I was knocked out for a while. And when I woke up, all my friends' faces were in my field of view as it started to reopen. And that was my first awareness of mortality, was from being, from climbing up into a tree and falling out and recognizing that this is a fragile, vulnerable life, and it can be taken away by having fun, by just being
Wow.
silly in trees. You could lose it. And so now I carry that into my safety workshops about tree climbing, as somehow that informs how I talk and how I feel about safety in trees.
Interesting. I think back, it reminds me of, once again, your story reminds me of something. The first memory I have of feeling fear from being injured. And I don't know how old I was. I was not old. I remember running to my father for comfort, but I was swinging on a low branch in a playground, and I had gone out away from the playground equipment and was just grabbing a low limb on a tree. I think it was a poplar, and I was swinging on it. I would just grab it and swing with all my might and let my legs go out, and I just was having a great old time. And suddenly the limb broke. I had no concept of, knowing what I know now, if I had watched a kid do it, I'd probably go, "Oh boy, that's gonna bust. Better watch out." But as a kid, you don't think of these things. And but I, when you described landing on your back, I didn't black out, but I landed. I think I must have landed on a root of a trunk flare, and oh, it hurt. And it was the first memory I have of, I had fallen and hurt my knees and things, but this was an injury where I wasn't sure what the consequences might be. It genuinely made me afraid. And I don't know, it would put me in contact with mortality, but certainly with my frailty as a human, and when you de the way you described that fall reminded me of that, and I'd forgotten about that experience until just now. We've all probably spent time swinging off of something or other that, when we look back on it, maybe wasn't the most secure thing.
Well, I remember I was laughing when I hit the ground.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when I woke up, I was still laughing, but I was out. I was truly out. I was gone.
So you think you just got knocked unconscious by the blow, the sheer impact?
And I think the pine duff in that forest saved me. Had it not been a monoculture of pine, and the forest floor was,
Right.
thick with pine, I might not have made that one. So,
And what an example of resiliency, and how, depending where you are in the forest, your falls or your mistakes, maybe you're protected by the forest itself.
I never blamed the tree. I didn't blame it. I took responsibility. I said I was doing something I shouldn't have done in a small tree that couldn't handle the weight that we were. Like, this was dumb on our part, and the tree was innocently broken. And I never blamed the tree for breaking. It was me. And that actually plays into my safety training workshops now, is that when you pull the trigger, when nothing's moving, and you have it all rigged, and then you pull the trigger, you're putting it all in motion. And that's why you should be working with your checklist, understanding the physics involved, and then taking responsibility for the whole site. And all that goes right back to that moment when when that tree snapped and broke out underneath me. I caused the motion.
Yep. Well, and a lesson in responsibility. You know, I think that that's an interesting concept. I probably spent some of my life not accepting or denying to a certain extent. So how would you relate? How do you think trees handle responsibility or accept that?
That's an interesting question. I've spent my whole life thinking that trees don't have consciousness. However, I met a dude in Colorado, in Crestone, Colorado, who was building a machine that would play music from the electrical impulses of plants and trees.
Wow.
And the pinyon pines had a totally different sound than the cottonwoods, and the cottonwoods had a totally different sound than the aloe plant. And the last time I checked in with him, he was telling me how the sounds, when you put the plants in relation to each other, the sounds change. So when they're by themselves, they do one thing. When you put it in, let's say you take a pinyon pine sapling and you slide an aloe plant over to it, the music changes. And in some of the recent books that have been put out, talking about pheromones and different chemicals that the trees pass, I don't know about responsibility, but certainly community, I think trees feel.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've read the book, Finding the Mother Tree. There's something there, but I'm not sure it goes as deep as responsibility. I think we're the ones that put things in motion more often.
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess that I anthropomorphize trees and situations with trees probably more than I don't know if it's more than I should, but I certainly find myself doing that. But I do that with my dog, too.
I do that also. It helps me translate the slow-moving world of trees that I see for, you know, I'm 6 decades into living, and I grew up in Vermont in the forest. But 6 decades of living with trees in close proximity with trees, the people that I work for don't have that luxury. And when I anthropomorphize a tree, I often do it for their benefit to help them connect more deeply with what it is that we're talking about so that they can grasp the situation. And a little bit of it rubs off on me every time I do it too. So,
yeah. Well, analogies and stories, you know, they're kind of closely connected, and they use allegories or symbolism, right, as a big part of education and training, really. And it's one of the mechanisms I think that most humans connect with. You know, we've said it before in the show and in other trainings, like some of the world's greatest teachers told stories. And, you know, stories are a blend of, what is it, like, human biasness, experience, and profound ignorance.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, on that topic of stories, though, Duane, I can't help but think of all the hours I spent splitting wood for my dad, and how every time I split a piece of wood open, I was thinking that piece is telling me a story.
Wow.
And so I was, I don't know, between the ages of probably 13, 14, and 17, maybe a little younger even. He probably gave me an axe when I was 10. But it seemed a long time I was splitting wood for our family's heat. He'd get the wood delivered and cut, and I would just split it and stack it. And so years later, when I ran into writings from Alex Shigo, and I opened up the book, and there's all these dissected trees and crotches.
Yeah.
And all these branch unions. And I think back to all the years I spent splitting wood by hand, and reading the rings and reading the cracks and reading how I was going to make that happen, and how the tree was telling me a story of how to have success with it, and how that translated to Alex Shigo teaching me a deeper level of that. And then now my own work in trees, I'm trying to read the living tree before I open it up to make sure I'm safe. I think often about Norm's accident and how he was, you know, so proficient and so knowledgeable, and he was reading a tree, and, you know, maybe the tree didn't, you know, give up its secret.
Mark, you mean Peter, right?
Right. And so I think about that almost every time I'm climbing and I put my hand around the back of a tree, place it in a particular location, and I find a woodpecker hole. And I think to myself that the tree is guiding me to tell it's telling its story to me by guiding my hand to the woodpecker hole I wouldn't have seen and would have climbed over without recognizing it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what's guided me towards doing actually a ceremony to thank the trees before every tree I work on. I learned that from a Native American fellow that I know who holds Sweat Lodge, and he taught me about the power of holding ceremony before pruning or removing or, you know, disturbing the roots or working in any way on a tree, is thanking it for its gifts and letting it know what you're planning on doing and giving it an opportunity to tell its story to you. And that's what like a track course is about, is getting the sensitivity to learn how to let the tree tell its story to you, and you being quiet enough to listen and be open to it.
Yeah. I remember one of the colleagues I would work with is a consulting arborist in Omaha, and I met him through my friendships with Dr. Shigo, and we would do tree biology workshops after Alex passed. You know, we were a couple of the individuals that Alex kind of charged with carrying on his. He had a few of us. Well, there was quite a, I don't know how many there were. He called us the Tree Function Education Group that he'd got to know, and he selected and kind of said, you are people that need to continue on teaching biology in the style that I do it, and I think you have the capacity to it. None of us dared to do it until after he passed away, but and this guy's name is Jack Phillips, and we would go to a site to where we're going to do a course, or we did several of these tree biology courses. We haven't done them. It was all quite a few years ago. Anyway, he would stop, and we'd have to get a coffee. He always wanted his espresso, which, you know, okay, fine. But he would even before we got out of the parking lot, he would just look at the park or whatever the scene was, and he'd sit there and look and watch. And I'd be like, well, are we going to go and like get started here? Are we going to go look at the trees? And he says, well, I am. Just let me. And it was what you're talking about. It was his ceremony of, you know, getting into the place that he was in. And I realized that this is an important part of it. You know, this is an important part. It's not just, you know, and it absolutely applies to something like tree risk assessment, because, you know, what's moving on? What's going on in and around? You know, what's the air like? You hear sounds, you realize that there's, you know, traffic or noises, or the frequency of people passing by, and just the amount of time it takes to have a coffee. You can observe a lot of things that you could very easily miss if you just walk up to the tree, you know, let alone look when you get to the tree. And I have a friend that actually, you listened to his podcast, I think you mentioned, Mr. Dave Lutz, and you know, he took quite a fall. And subsequent to that, and Dave is a Native First Nations individual, and he does that ceremony. Like he does a bit of a ceremony for every tree that he works on as well, like what you're describing. And I think that, you know, isn't it interesting the correlation between a JSA or a pre-work or a pre-climb inspection that's required by law, suppose, you know, like more and more so that we're trying to, you know, impart this habit to the industry to get into, and yet it's really part of the ceremony.
It is. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, we could call it a tree ceremony inspection. No, but you know, it really is. And I think to connect with that part of it, I don't know if we're of that generation, Mark, or what, but where there it seems to be, or maybe it's our age, I don't know, that I don't want to use the word sentient, but a spiritual, or, you know, you mentioned you don't think of trees as having conscious, but I certainly get a sense you feel a connection or that there is a spiritualism there.
So consciousness is one thing. I don't know, the awareness and the ability to interact with your environment. I mean, certainly they put out pheromones and certain chemicals when they're under attack by insects and things. But I do teach energy to all my workshops. I teach about the Taurus energy. So if you look at a picture of the Earth's magnetic field and you see this round apple-shaped, you know, sphere of magnetic energy around the Earth that protects us from gamma rays and all that other stuff. Well, scientists also can see that same energy field around you. Like you have this flow of energy, and the woo-woo people call it your aura or whatever, but it's actually just an energy field, right? Positive and negative ions, you know, around your body, and trees have the same thing. And if you think about all the ancient Celtic pictures of drawings of the root system down below, like when you look at Yggdrasil, the tree of life, and you see the root system down and the crown above, they always say as above, so below, right? And it's a feeding kind of system with the trunk carrying the phloem and xylem up and down the center and the energy flowing around the drip line of the tree, because we always talk about the drip line being the edge of the root system. And the whole thing is kind of a package, right? And it's 360 degrees. It's not just two-dimensional. And so there is energy around that tree, and that includes the squirrels, the chipmunks, the algae, the lichen, the mushrooms, the fungi, the mycorrhiza, everything that's associated with that entire canopy and root structure is holding that energy of that Taurus field. And then when I, as a Taurus field, enter into the field of the tree's Taurus field, I am now in relationship with that tree. And so consciousness, well, obviously it's not a speaking consciousness, but if you listen quietly enough, if you walk into the field of a dead tree, you have a feeling, right? You're like, okay, gravity's working here, ants are working here, termites possibly, fungus is working. And that has a certain energy to it. A really dead ash tree has a certain energy to it. And then when you walk into the aura or the energy field of a beautiful spreading beech tree with 90-degree branch unions going forever, and there's all sorts of things going on in that tree, you know, all types of wildlife and critters on the leaves and the, you know, the boring beetle on the bark and the roots. It's a whole different feeling if you really do slow down and try to feel it. And that's what I try to teach people to do, whether it's a customer or it's an employee or it's a trainee in one of my workshops.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I relate to it, I should say. You know, I relate to that concept for sure. You know, and I think personally, I find it's less individualistic. It's like you mentioned about how the music man puts the plant together and the sound changes. You know, that's where the concept of the human forest, like our, you know, and I don't think that it's relegated to proximity. Like the energy that's happening between us three now is a unique vibration in and of itself because we're connected, even though it's just digitally. But I think it transcends this realm that we quantify as space, you know, where it's an energy field that we can tap into, whether you're beside each other or not, you know. And the forest is such a great example of that, because you take all those Taurus fields and meld them and blend them, and man, what a symphony of energy, you know?
Yeah, so you take how we interact at a TCIA trade show where we're being interrupted every few seconds by another energy field entering our conversation, you know, and it's just chaos, but it's all love, but it's all chaos. And then we have our days where we're out and we're 70 feet up a tree. Our energy field is merged with the trees,
right,
and we're alone with our thoughts in that moment. And we're still the same person, but it's not chaos. And that has to do with the energy. You know what you're going to expect in the energy field of a dead, dying, senescent ash tree, and all the things that are going on underneath that bark and all the things that are getting ready to break off. And so you have a different JSA, a different approach underneath a dead ash tree than you do a beautiful teenage beech tree with 40-foot limbs already, you know.
Well, and it's having the ability to connect, because it's so easy to mute that sound or vibration with hurriedness or being in our own heads, you know, so caught up in our own thought processes of what, you know, maybe it's the task at hand, maybe it's what happened at breakfast with your loved one, maybe it's the fear of a diagnosis that's impending, you know, whatever it is. If that takes you out of that realm, it exposes you to risk. And you know, when people say, I don't know why he made that call, why would he do it like that? You know, that's maybe where some of the whys lie, where we just, how can you know without knowing all of the details that, you know, the nuances that took place? You know, I remember Dr. Amanda talking about dehydration and how if you're not drinking enough water, and you've been playing hard the night before, like often young arborists do, you're so dehydrated, it literally affects you like having an impairment. You know, it's literally you're impaired. And you wouldn't even...
You're not in your right mind.
Yeah, and so not only are you impaired physically, but you're impaired spiritually. And I think we do not... You know, you mentioned the woo-woo thing. I think a lot of things get thrown into the woo-woo category and dispensed with because they're not scientifically understood. And I find it fascinating. You're blending science in with, you know, there's scientific principles to this, but some of it's very non-scientific as well.
Some of it's very practical. So for instance, you're talking about disturbing the field, right? Or disturbing that energy. So if you watch two different arborists approach a tree, and one of them is humble and open and vulnerable and, you know, really taking in the forested landscape, reading the forested landscape, which is a book my college professor wrote. But if you have one like that, and then you have another arborist that comes in who's egotistical and is only seeing the world through how this tree is, they say, oh, you're only as good as your last tree or whatever. And they're approaching the tree as an Instagram post. Those two arborists approach the trees totally different, and the outcomes can often be totally different.
And to lend the outcome or to suggest that the outcome is tied to that energy or persona or attitude is pretty hard for some people to accept or understand, you know, or to believe, and it just flatly gets refused, I think, at sometimes. But I'm in your realm. I believe that is in fact the case, and it's a tough one though to quantify, I suppose.
It often takes a lot of courage to bring these types of topics up in a group of, let's say, I might be training municipal workers to use chainsaws. And these guys drive snow plows and backhoes and bucket loaders and bulldozers, and then they use chainsaws occasionally. And to get them to break down their walls of traffic cones and, you know, safety vests and rules, and to actually think about what's going on with a tree, it can take a lot of courage to say that to a group of burly dudes that don't think that way normally, you know. But I take that risk because I think it's my obligation, because my mentors and shadow mentors have brought me to this place, and I think it's my obligation to share it, no matter how difficult it might personally be for me, because you never know when you're going to save somebody's life. You'll never know, because they're keep living, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, that, you know, that it's one of the the strange non-measurable results of safety training. You know, is that nothing happened, so therefore did it work? Well, it must have, you know. but I've always found that kind of fascinating. Like, what are the measurable results? Well, no accident. Well, but then you could look at a company that did nothing and they, you know, fortunately didn't have one.
Yeah.
From Shigo would often talk about, well, I don't know if often, but I recall very clearly him talking about, actually I have a video, a clip of him talking about this, but he said, there's no such thing as green waste. Green waste, that's a human term. When I hear people talk about green waste, I want to say that's a nice shirt you've got on, but I don't want to discuss it with them. And then he said, I've never thrown anything out of my place. Never.
Yeah.
You know, and it's exactly what you're talking about, right? I don't know if you got a, you know, we're lucky enough to spend much time with Dr. Shigo, but that was a big thing of his, you know, that he wished the industry would have moved along with. You know, I know that this manuscript still exists, or I believe it does, because I don't think anyone would have thrown it out. But I was in his office on one of my visits to his house. I spent a few days there, and there was a manuscript, a large document above on the top of a filing cabinet in his office down at his little office in the cottage where they, you know, right where actually he passed away. And I asked him what it was, and you know, I brought it down. I was looking at it, and he kind of took it from my hands, and he put it back up in its spot. He said, the industry isn't ready for this yet. And I was like, he said, when everyone understands, and like when I see that my other books have been read and understood and it's made a change, then we can move on to this, because right now there's no point. People aren't understanding or haven't grasped the concepts of my other books. Why would I give them another one?
I'm dying to know. What was it?
Well, it you know, I know that a lot of that stuff went to, and I don't know where it is. And we need to get Tim Walsh on the show, Tony, because he might have an idea where it is. And because Judy doesn't know where it is, his daughter, but she recalls something of it as well. But and you know, some people think Shigo might be arrogant or rude, but it, you know, he often would talk about how he did what he did to get everybody to learn and understand so we could all move forward together. And that's always, I think, that's a difficult concept. But, you know, I we just need to keep trying. You know, you mentioned, Mark, you mentioned the Instagram post, the guy walking up to the tree doing an Instagram post. I wanted to... You know, you also mentioned six decades. You know, and we're all in the the halfway to centurion or more club. I think Tony, maybe I'm pretty sure he's there, pretty close. Anyway, what is the? Well, first of all, I'm curious what your first experience climbing. How did you get into a tree, and what were you using for equipment when you first started as an arborist?
That's a great question. And that actually brings up something that I wanted to talk about anyway.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about mentors.
Ah.
And I wanted to talk about shadow mentors.
Yeah.
So for me, mentors are the people who were my mentors was Melissa Levangie.
Uh-huh.
And Bear Levangie.
Wonderful.
Introduced me to Michael Tane.
Ah, okay.
And Michael, through a roundabout way, introduced me to Rich Hattier.
Okay.
And in those discussions, I got introduced to Tree Buzz, which put me unknowingly in the company of Tom Dunlap.
Uh-huh.
But because my contemporaries were people like Mark Powell, Stefan Zimmerman, and Chip Hildreth, and Nora, I became a real devotee to Tree Buzz, and those people became my mentors, my guideposts, who showed me the right ways to do things. I always consider Michael as the Mark Twain of tree work. You know, we talk about storytellers and philosophy. He's just so rich with that. And Rich Hattier, in his circumspect way, is the same if you listen carefully, right? And then Melissa is a paragon of virtue and integrity, as is Bear.
Yeah.
And then the Tree Buzz group really brought me the humor and the dark humor of, ouch, I worked all day yesterday, I hurt, okay, I'm going to go do this again tomorrow because I love it. Don't I love it, right? And they allowed me to keep coming back every day. And then I've had shadow mentors. I've had people who were mentors or hired themselves out as mentors who are terrible, terrible people who don't understand training, don't understand human nature, and are rude and dismissive. And that was the old way that people used to get trained to do tree work. And what I've learned is that shadow mentors are just as important as the positive mentors. If you ever, you ever make shadow puppets on the wall to make the duck or the whatever, and you can then change your hand positions because you can see the shadow and you want the shadow to be the relief of the thing, right? And so, like, when I look at how my shadow mentors guided me and it was so terrible, I can actually look in relief to say, well, I don't want to hit that button. I want to hit the opposite button. I don't want to hit that button. I want to hit the opposite button. And they actually inform me just as clearly and deeply as my positive mentors.
Absolutely.
That being said, my first experience to climbing was with a shadow mentor. I took a class with a shadow mentor, and the list of things that were distasteful and horrible about it are as long as my arm. And I have informed all the ways that I train and teach and speak and approach the work as the opposite of that ever since my very first indoctrination into tree climbing.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah, it's it's the concept of without adversity, you don't have strength. Like, without strain or stress or pressure or heat, it's a diamond doesn't become a diamond without a lot of heat and pressure. And and shadow mentors provide that, right? They give us the examples of not to pass judgment. I like the way you put that, because it can be used to a benefit, and maybe that's even part of the purpose. That's one of the things that I really struggle with, I guess, altruistically. I like to think everyone has positive qualities, and I do value all life. And I've gotten myself in trouble, I think, in my lifetime by not, maybe extracting myself from unhealthy relationships. Maybe you could call it a sense of codependency or so on. But nevertheless, learned from those hardships, whether it be as a child or even on into my career. And as shadow mentors, I really like that model and concept. And, it's the whole, you and I haven't talked a whole lot before. We've met one, we had one face-to-face conversation at a conference. And, I don't know, I energetically wanted you on the show. And, you listed a bunch of names of people that I actually know very, very well. And yet you and I have not, completed the loop, so to speak, like we are today. And I don't think it's by accident or coincidence at all, and it's part of this energy field that we're talking about. This was inevitable, to happen. So, it's just so, I don't know what the word is, it just puts me in a real thankful, grateful moment, that we're having that, and realizing, we've kind of known each other really quite well in a lot of ways, because, Michael and I are very close, and I know Melissa better than Bear, but I know them both very well. And some of the other people you mentioned as well. I don't know, Tony, if you're feeling it too, but or maybe you knew that, but because Tony, you're very close with Michael as well.
Yeah, I hadn't realized all the common connections, but it never shocks me, because really, the tree community is very small. Like, the world gets much smaller, I think, sometimes too, and the way things that they come together we're fine. And it's, yeah, that the I love the concept of the shadow mentors, because it's sort of it's along lines with where, the philosophy of the obstacle becomes the way, right? Like, during the course of a day, you're gonna deal with mean, unruly people, but that's just an opportunity to get better at handling yourself with mean and unruly people. That's just an opportunity to grow and get better.
Yeah, and just to finish that thought about shadow mentors is that in the beginning, after the experiences that I had, I was angry and I wasn't happy with that person. And over the years now, I'm in 24 years doing this, now I can allow that person just to be who they are and watch their journey as any other person, and I don't hold animosity toward them. While I still recognize them as my shadow mentor, they might be a positive mentor to someone else, but in my situation, at their point in their history, they were a shadow mentor to me. And I always hold the door open that they could change and be a better mentor going forward. So I want to be clear about that. I don't hold animosity, because how valuable is it for me to curb my vocabulary in front of a group to make sure that I don't do those same things. And without having that wall to run into, without having my sensibilities, pushed hard, I wouldn't have re maybe given it as much like weight as I do. And so I thank the shadow mentors that I've had for showing me the what it looks like when you step off the path. And that actually brings up all the things that we've been talking about are dancing around the same thing. The Arborist personal development program that I'm building is called the Growth Ring. And the way that I see it is that as a tree puts on growth rings, and we talked about it already, that anything that happens to that tree is compartmentalized. And then the reaction wood determines how it looks, in future years and the aesthetics of it and whether or not you can read it. But when you cut the tree and you read the rings, you can see where the drought was and where the lots of rains were and where the tree that fell down next to it, scarred the bark, or where someone put a tap of, a maple tap into it. And that growth ring metaphor works perfectly with people because, as you were just saying, Duane, even though you and I haven't spent a lot of time in each other's proximity, our paths have been parallel. And because of our conversation today, I'm fundamentally a different person because I've got an impact to one of my growth rings in a positive or negative way from meeting you and hanging out with Tony today. And I'm fundamentally a different person after interacting with you both. And so there's a change in my personal growth rings that I hold forever, just like a tree holds that forever. And when the tree senescent goes into senescence and passes away and rots away, that's lost to time, just like when I die. All those little nuances that you imparted to me that I carry to the next training and the next training and the next training when I die, they all re get returned back to the fabric. And so the growth ring is a super powerful metaphor for me personally. And the way that I teach it is I try to promote the terms novice, apprentice, master, and sage. And I equate that to a tree world of being a sapling, being a teen, being a mature tree, and then being in senescence. And so our growth, our personal growth, mimics and mirrors the tree's personal growth. And you might be a novice in rigging, but you might be a sage in a whole different field. Like Chip Hildreth was a computer guy when he first came into arboriculture. So he would say, "Oh, I'm just an apprentice at climbing, but I know how to do Perl programming," or whatever, right? So he was a sage in one place, but he was an apprentice in another. And so in my classes, I try to ask people, "Where are you a novice? Give me an example. Give me an example of where you're an apprentice. Where are you a master? Where are you a sage?" I try to get them to recognize that if you're a novice in a room, you don't have to have your chest puffed out because you're a sage in another area. you can be just as open as a not any other novice in the room. One last topic on that is, our arborist careers mimic that tree growth and human development. And one of the things that's really important to me is preserving the sages. So you talk about us being in our 50th and 60th years, right? So what we have is we're aging a lot of people out of the industry, and we're not able to bring a lot of people in. We're having a hiring crisis. I think that's no news to anybody. But the valuable resource that we're losing when people get hurt or just leave or are marginalized is we're losing those people that have 20 and 30 and 40 years of experience working in trees. And we don't exalt them as a sage the way that we used to maybe 400 or 500 years ago. Like the matriarch or the patriarch was really respected. And now a lot of times because of production schedules or shareholder profit expectations, a lot of the sages get pushed off to the side to filing saws or driving trucks, and then they just lose their self-esteem. And no one ever gives them permission to be a mentor or a leader. No one ever gives them the self-esteem to say, wow, you've got 30 years experience. Let's hone some of the rough edges about your speech patterns and put you in front of the group and see if you can help save some of these guys from making some of the mistakes you did. And so the growth ring is actually built with a little bit of a skew towards the older population and giving them the permission to be the leaders that they are without having been given permission.
Well, you're talking about the heartwood, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And when you lose that, yeah, cylinders are strong, but...
Yeah, the heartwood is a... You know, but, I agree, and that's a... It is... You know, like Don Blair, when he was on the podcast, he referenced an old, I think he said it was a African proverb or some type of saying. And it goes something like this. When an elder, well, I'll use your example. When a sage or elder passes away, a library burns down. And, you know, and it's just the concept of, you know, yeah, and I never have heard it quite so bluntly, I guess. But I wonder if, you know, it's interesting. You know, Shigo, as he got older, his following continued. And, you know, there were those that, you know, I think really respected him. And not everyone agreed with it. Shigo was very outspoken and almost, you know, fanatical or religious in his teachings, you know. And you became kind of a zealot of his in a way, and some didn't. But I think he always did command a respect, and I think we have that to a certain extent in the educational realm, because someone maybe be a professor or something like that, or an educator. But you make a really strong point of those that have gone through the school of hard knocks and stayed there. You know, those sergeants or generals, or maybe more like sergeants or platoon leaders that have stayed in the trenches and retired there or retired from there. And then that library, you know, how do we capture that library of knowledge? You know, and, you know, that part of what this podcast was hoping to do. And it was one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about your first climbing experience and the equipment you were on, but also dovetail that with, how do we communicate what you're talking about? How do we preserve that legacy and impart the importance of it to the next generation? Or does it happen naturally, or do we have a duty of care to try to, encourage that or plant those seeds so they can germinate?
So, in the growth ring, I have a plan to, and here's the trick, right? A lot of these people that we want to gather that information from have been traumatized over their career by bosses and people who treated them like crap. I think it's no secret in tree work that, you know, back in the day, they used to throw a saddle on somebody, point them up a tree and say, you know, take that tree down or you're fired. You know, don't bother coming back tomorrow. And so that trauma of jumping into something with no training or being beat up, verbally every day. It's hard to get some of these older folks to speak the language, to have enough confidence to speak out loud in the first place, or to speak a language that can be understood. We got to take some of the rough edges, and that's why I call it a personal development program instead of an arborist safety training program. It's really personal development, and I always say I want to train the person before the tree worker, right? Because the person is what's important, not the getting the job done is important to the shareholders, but if we don't come home with somebody on a given day, that person's way more important than the shareholders.
And it's not the tree, it's the tree that's important, not the saw, or the climbing line.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, Tony, it makes me think of your boot camp, and I mean that's a lot of what you go for in that program that you have put together with Phil.
Yeah, it's sort of the same idea, just on the opposite end of it. The idea behind boot camp was to give somebody, well, I mean, quite frankly, when you're done with boot camp, you're either gonna be a lifelong arborist or you're gonna run screaming away from it. Which, there's, as being a trainer for so long now, there's, some of the toughest conversations I've had with people that they really want to do tree work, but they're just not suited to do it. Whether it be mentally, physically, emotionally. And yes, say it's like, either you change or get out of the industry, because it's not going to end well. It's like you have to want to do this work on many levels. You can do it for a while for a paycheck, you certainly can. But to be successful at it, to grow in it, to build a skill set and a knowledge base that's going to last you, 25, 30, 40 more years. It's a commitment, and you can't.
And allow you to last.
Exactly. And it is, I just, I look back on my career. I wish somebody when I was in my 20s and early 30s would have just told me to take care of myself better physically. And it's not that I had any major injuries, knock on wood, it was good, but life would have been happier through my 30s and 40s had I drank more water on those hot days, had I got more sleep, had I gone home and not had a six pack of beer and a bag of chips for dinner, but had a salad and went to bed at 8:30, because I was getting up at 4:30 the next. And I wish that somebody would have told me to find ways to manage the stress and tension of the work other than going home and drinking a six pack and eating a bag of chips. And to find those other ways to manage that. And not that I really don't have any regret. Well, can't say I don't have any regrets, because to say you have no regrets is to say you haven't learned anything, right? I've learned plenty. There's
True.
plenty of things I would do differently. But I don't, I'm not sitting here saying, oh, I wouldn't turn back the clock. I don't know how much I would change, because the path would be, the destination would be different. But yeah, those are the types of things that, very early on, that if, somebody had told me that, it might have just made life easier or better. Who knows? Maybe I would have not been an arborist, but maybe that was the path.
So let me ask a question of you guys. In your estimation, how many of the sages, of the people who are aging out of tree work, can stay in tree work in some capacity? Like we always say, well, when I'm done cutting trees, I'm going to be a trainer or I'm going to do something else in trees. How many people actually do that?
Well, I have to say, I, that's a good question. Number one, I'm finding it myself where, I purposely, for various reasons, distance myself from the day-to-day workings of training. Like where, so, it's getting to the point where I won't have had, I may not have taught a rigging class for a year or two, which, seems unheard of, but it certainly is the case for climbing. I haven't actually taught a climbing class, and we were doing some stuff with our instructors, and I realized I'm actually not even qualified in my own company to teach a course that I wrote, just because I just haven't done it. Like I can climb, but I wouldn't want to teach our modern tree climbing course. I just don't, I climb the way I climb, and it's just different. And with it, it's really prompted some thought in me, because you know, I've sensed that and this may just be in my head, and I want to be careful here, but I sense a less, you get less respect because, you know, like there's that shirt you see out there, do you even climb, you know, question mark, like, you know, maybe I don't climb anymore, but let me tell you, like I did for a long time. And I guess that's kind of what I was getting at. Like, it seems like there's like for example, SRS, if you ain't SRS, you're nothing sort of thing. It almost is like a, and it's like, no, you know, and when we had Mark on the show, Mark Chisholm, I was, you know, he's like, hey man, like, it's all important. I still use both methods a lot. And I don't know if that's the case with everyone, but, it seems like if you ain't doing it, you ain't worth listening to sometimes. And that is, I think, what you're talking about, which, you know, I have to say, I think I've been accepting that as a reality, and maybe I need to even tool my thinking on that. I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but I'm curious what Tony would say.
I would say, you know, the direct answer to your question, Mark, is no, I don't think a lot of people that you would consider a sage move on. I think they just tend to get out of the industry. Well, I think most of them work until they're so injured or physically unable to do the job. Because I don't think that organically the industry doesn't have an exit plan for people like that. You have to choose it, right? You have to lay it out and you have to choose it. Because it's what I did. I mean, when my professional arborist career started a little bit later because I was in the military for a while and tried not to be an arborist. And then when I came out and decided that, well, it was inevitable, I'm going to be an arborist, I told myself at that point that if this is going to be my career, I'm going to do this work. I'm going to get paid for what I do with my hands till I'm about 40, and then I want to get paid for what I know. And I was able to kind of make that work. I still, you know, did the work and worked with my hands and still, you know, climbed trees well past my 40, you know, when I turned 40. But I was earning much more of my living from what I knew in that point. And I structured my production career to fit that model. So it was a choice that I actually made myself. It was not, you know, it wasn't something that I just fell into. And I don't think a lot of people make that choice. I think that, you know, the natural progression from, you know, start dragon brush, then you start climbing, and then you become a crew foreman. And then, I don't know, maybe you go into sales. If you don't like people enough to go into sales, you do plant healthcare because that's got to be easier. Well, I don't know where that came from. And then, you know, and I don't, and I'm not saying that, you know, I've run into plenty of arborists that are well into their 60s and 70s, and they're still very productive and they still work and they love it. But I've also run into probably more people that are in their 60s and 70s and just don't have another option. This is how they earn a living. And they're going to keep doing it until they physically and or mentally cannot do it anymore.
Yeah.
There is no exit plan for them.
So like you're driving the bus for yourself. I mean, you know, barring anything untoward happening, but you're driving the bus. And I guess the real question is how many of us across the industry are driving the bus with our career? Yeah, what I'm hoping to do with that is to allow a few more people to begin driving their own bus as trainers. If they want that off ramp, they can come on and start learning how to drive the bus.
Yeah.
And I think there's options other than training too. You know, there's, as my brother owner of the tree company and a family company, you're always looking for good people. And we've had people work with us that were in that, you know, well into their 60s. And they weren't climbing trees anymore. We didn't want them to climb trees anymore. But just having a person like that on a crew with a wealth of experience had value in and of itself. So we've tried to make room for people like that, that, you know, they don't want to train, right? That's not their thing. But, you know, they're training, but they're training in an informal way. They're training because they're out there in the crew. And the young climber can look down and say, hey, you know, John, what about this? You know, that could be handled. And so, you know, there's many careers, there's many paths for people to take other than just training. We had the conversation with Matt Follett and we asked him, you know, point blank, like, is there a future in being a research arborist? And he couldn't say yes fast enough. You know, there's a need for people that have the physical and the technical skills to do this work, to lend what they can do and know to the academic world, right? Because the researcher might have a great idea for, tree dynamics, but he or she has no clue how to get the instrument 40 foot up in the tree. There's plenty of avenues. I think you just have to open your mind, and it's not, in my estimation, it's not a field that lends itself to thinking outside the box. But I think people are going to have to if they want to keep working. I mean, I look now, like if you were to turn back the clock and I was in my 40s now, my climbing career would change because everything is so mechanized. It's like the days of me having to, climb a big tree and rig every piece of wood down are gone. And I mean, I'm thankful for it. My back is thankful for it. But that skill set just isn't needed as much anymore. So if I was 35 right now, I would have to make some decisions about my career because it wouldn't have progressed the same way. I wouldn't have had, 15 or 20 more years of climbing and rigging and doing removals at a highly manual, labor because, I can't remember the last time I took down a big tree without a lift in Ekraine. It's just the way we do the work now,
Right. And on that topic, I'm actually hedging my bets because I'm building the growth ring. I'm also doing FIDS and fibers. I'm also building a qualified splicer program with a break test machine. And I'm trying to figure out which one of these things is going to feed me like going forward, because I have no idea. You don't know what the demand's going to be for any of it. And so I want to drive my bus so bad that I'm going to drive several buses until one of them works, But I also feel like I have an abundance of ability and vision, and I'd like to share the abundance that I have with other people who maybe don't feel like they can drive their own bus, and offer them, places to do that.
I can say from my own experience and having constructed the career that I've had, driving many buses is the way to go because right now can't tell you how many businesses would have to fold simultaneously for me not to be able to work somewhere. And I've done that on purpose, right? Because I like to do different things and I think that, value can be added in many, many different ways. And when I left production full time and went into training full time, the freedom to set my own schedule is something that I just wouldn't trade. I tell people now I'm unemployable, right? You want me to show up 7 o'clock every morning? Nah, I don't think
I'm not
so.
your guy.
I've been there, done that. I got the shirt. I mean, it doesn't. Do you even work? That's the shirt I should have.
Well, and there's something to be said for just youth. And I had an old a friend who's still a good friend. He'd always say youth is wasted on the young. And it's a tongue-in-cheek statement, but the old saying, if I knew now, or if I knew then what I know now with this body and this, if I had the mind, the things you would do differently, which is always part of experience, right? But is the I really have a hope that we're entertaining enough on these podcasts with and that part of the hope is that our human forest will extend into the new growth, the canopies that are coming up underneath through the old growth, right? And that we are actually able to provide a positive mentorship, in some way, even through these recordings.
You take a look at what we are, we're all sages of one form or another, right? And now we're novices in a new technology, traveling down a path that we're novices at. And yeah, it might be entertaining for the wrong reasons, but it's going to be entertaining, right?
Right. Good point. Good point. I'm always pleased with outcomes, and like this morning has been no exception. The one person that I have to find my I found myself distracted in my mind as you guys have talked is Nora Bryant. I absolutely have to get her on the show now. And I had the what I would consider the luck or the fortune of being the first person that ever taught her, and she was just incredible. And she's from Calgary, and she had this she was the bug lady kind of thing. She would write articles in the newspaper on insects, and she was just expanding and spreading herself to do other things, and she started coming to, well, she ended up working at an harvest company. They sent her to, this company would send employees to her courses, and she came to, I think, Chainsaw First, and then ended up in a climate, and I could just see in her, I was like, Bunora, you got to be careful. Like, you're falling into the arborist realm here. Like, this could change your life. Like, and, you know, what prophetic statement it was, because I had no idea. But at the same time, I'm absolutely not surprised. And watching her progress from the life that she had in Calgary and how she found her way through the trees into where she is now is just absolutely a story that's got to be told. And we need to get her on the show. But, you know, what can I say? It's just really cool connection and a great memory that you've brought to me. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Nora is the dictionary definition of determination. She's amazing. Yeah. I love that woman.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I'll never forget. She came to our first climbing competition. Drove all the way to Winnipeg, like 15 hours from Calgary. And I was like, wow, you're serious. And she never looked back. Never did look back. It was quite astonishing. Well, you know, we're in around that stage. And, you know, I really want to thank you for being on the show, number one, and for sharing from your heart, because I really felt that came through. I feel that with all our guests, I'm not trying to say it's, anyways, I don't need to be apologetic about that, but I really appreciate it. And it's been really, I guess I'm always pleasantly surprised. I don't know what to, you don't go into something with expectations, but it's always better than I expected for some reason. It's just been a really great episode. And, you know, we always reserve the right to have do-overs or guests on the show again. And, because there's always more to talk about, and I think that this is, you know, this, you're one of those people we probably that easily could extend to.
Yeah, I feel like we missed out on all the ropes and splicing and training in that area. We didn't get a chance to talk about that, so maybe that'd be a good topic for another one.
Yeah, you know, I it's quite amazing actually when you think about it. Of all the topics we talked about, splicing. But I just assume we'd probably end up talking more about that than anything else.
You know, we often use the analogy, our the stream of conversation is literally a stream. Yeah. It just flows on wherever it wants to go, which is fine. Mm. It's always good. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you, Mark. And I do have to mention, Mark, I don't know, Duane, if I told you, Mark is one of our Patreon supporters now. We have a grand total of three. You included, Duane. So
yeah, but you know who the other one is? The other one is Michael.
Yeah, House, Michael. Yeah. We like Duane said, we always deserve the right to, you know, have another conversation. You're always welcome back. We figure eventually we're going to run out of people that want to talk to us, so we'll just have to go back through the loop again.